Transmissions Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Woods. Joining me is a special guest. He's a writer over at Hoop Mag. He's a writer at Today's Fast Break. He's a writer over at B-Ball Breakdown. It's Josh Eberle. Josh, how you doing, my man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
No problem. So this is the second time we've actually recorded this. We recorded Wednesday afternoon, and due to some technical difficulties, which hopefully doesn't happen this time, it wasn't posted. But anyway, let's go ahead and get started. First of all, you can find Josh on Twitter at Josh Eberle, which is E-B-E-R-L-E-Y. Make sure to give him a follow. A lot of good hoop talk and some other things as well. We're going to get started with a little Thunder talk. The Thunder are now 9-1 in their last 10 games. The last two games are a little difficult to count. There was a rather disappointing game against the Clippers, which you'd like to see the Thunder play a little bit better, but, you know, it is what it is. And then the game against Detroit, where Ibaka and Durant were both sidelined. Josh, can you tell me a little bit about what the difference, or if there is any, between the Thunder in the last 10 games and maybe the rest of the season, more specifically during that little slump they had post All-Star break?
Well, I think obviously they're playing a bit better brand of basketball. The net rating has improved by almost 4 points per 100 possessions. You see it in the numbers. You look at, you know, Westbrook stealing the show with all the triple doubles, and he's getting a lot of coverage. But his individual efficiency isn't great. There's a quote from Serge Ibaka. I know that you wrote a piece on it that I just wanted to touch on from Anthony Slater, and I guess I'll read it out to you. It says, from Anthony Slater, it says, when we play better, and this is Serge Ibaka talking, when we play better and everyone is touching the ball on offense, it helps our defense. It's hard. I'm going to tell you the truth. It's hard sometimes. When you play hard, you play your butt off. You play so hard on defense, then you come to offense and you're only going to be out there in the corner for 4, 5, 6, sometimes 8 minutes, and you don't even touch the ball. We human, man. It's hard. But we were playing great basketball. Russell and Kevin are doing a better job moving the ball, making us feel a part of the team too. And I think that's a great quote. And, you know, the numbers won't support it. I mean, Ibaka's actually taking less shots over the last 10 games. They're not really passing the ball any more than they were before. But if the team feels like that's the way, and I guess Westbrook and Durant's assist numbers have both gone up this month, then that's good. I mean, the team feels involved. That's what you want.
Yeah, something that I probably should have done more for that piece that you mentioned earlier was talk about Serge's touches. I didn't really research that too much. I researched the passes, the team passes, and you talked about Ibaka's shots, which sort of leads me to believe that he's probably touching the ball a little bit more, although I probably shouldn't just spout that without doing any research. But he's definitely playing a little better. He's more involved. He's hitting shots on the offensive end. His defense has slipped maybe some this year, although I think a lot of that is because he has to make up for more. You know, a lot of his minutes are now with Enes Kanter instead of whoever it was last year. And for all of the good things Kanter does, defense is obviously still a flaw. But some of that piece, I talked about just how terrible the Thunder really are in passes per game. And you can talk about whether or not it's useful, because, you know, if the ball ends up in Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant's hands, then for the most part, you're in a good situation. But Kevin Durant is a really good isolation scorer, which, you know, is usually what happens in the Thunder's offense. Russell Westbrook's really not. Russell Westbrook's one of the you know, in terms of volume and efficiency, he's probably one of the worst isolation scorers in the league, according to NBA.com stats. And so it's a little disconcerting that he does that over and over again. But, you know, recently it's been a little better. Westbrook, for all of his faults, is still a fantastic passer. He's really improved in that in his time in the league. And, you know, you've seen a lot of that recently. Durant's been fantastic, obviously. And then that whole thing on Ibaka, he feels like he's more involved, and thus he's playing a little better.
There's something to be said for touching the ball. And Westbrook's criticisms come from A, that he takes the ball away from Durant on a lot of possessions, and B, that he has some wild shot selection. And anyone who's played the game and who watched the game, you know that whether he's shooting or not, and Ibaka's not really shooting anymore, just feeling like you're involved on offense brings a little bit of confidence to your game. It makes you feel like you're involved. There's something to be said for the psyche that the team feels when they're not spectators on the court.
Yeah. Anyway, it's been fun to watch the last 10 games. The Thunder really look like they could make some noise, and we'll talk a little bit later about how much noise exactly. But it's been fun to watch for the past few weeks. So one of the reasons that they've been so good recently is Enes Kanter. Now, on the season, he's averaging over 12 points and right at around 8 rebounds per game in only, just under 21 minutes per night, which not starter minutes, certainly not max player minutes as we like to think about it. What are your thoughts on the minute distribution? Should he play more? Is it about right now? What do you think?
It's funny because Kanter is that guy that has a lot of people split. Because when you watch him play, the eye test tells you he's an instant plus. I mean, he's so all hard. He cleans up the boards. He finishes at the rim. You can actually count on him for a post touch. Like we said before, you want to get everyone involved. But Steven Adams only brings that heart and hustle. He doesn't have that composure on offense that Kanter does. But then you look at all the stat heads, and you look at the plus minus, and you realize that Kanter is this big negative on defense, and they're actually statistically better with him off the floor sometimes, but then his numbers are so good in 20 minutes, he's a walking double-double. It's this constant contradiction, but I really do believe that Kanter deserves more minutes. I think that when you look at what he's brought to the team, a third guy on offense, the hustle, the heart, it really does go a long way. I mean, this is a guy that he just brings it every night. He brings that competitive fire every night, and whether he plays 19 minutes or 30 minutes, you know what he's going to bring you. Maybe the small sample size is why the plus minus doesn't look so good, but I think he's a guy that has earned more time on the court.
Yeah, I was one of the not necessarily stat heads that didn't like him. I probably wouldn't put me in it. I'm not smart enough to be one of the stat heads anyway. But I didn't love his game. I didn't love that the Thunder signed him to a max contract this summer. I wrote a couple of pieces about how, it's not so much that it's just Enes Kanter, it's that, if that's the reason that Kevin Durant signs, then fantastic. But if he doesn't, then that's a giant allocation of resources to just have an Enes Kanter who's, might not be a starter. And that's how I felt in the summer. And now he's, I don't know how good he would be as a full-time starter, but he's been fantastic in his time with the Thunder. Like I said, the about 12 and a half points, 8 rebounds. He's, by offensive rebounding percentage, the best offensive rebounder in the league. He's not a good defensive player, but there's some value in defensive rebounding, and that's another thing that he does. He does very well. There's still a lot of things that he needs to learn. He got picked on a lot against the Warriors in the second two games. He was actually fantastic in the first one, but he got picked on, with a lot of back screens involving his man, where he's not a very good helper. But offensively, it's fantastic, and it's great that the Thunder can throw out a player off the bench who can give you 20, 21 minutes and fantastic production. His per minute stats are probably right on there with anybody in the league. So this is something that we didn't actually talk about, so this will be new in the last podcast, but what do you think about his chances for sixth man of the year?
I don't think they're great, because I think that you know how it is in the NBA. Once you're labeled as anything, it sticks with you forever. Mm-hmm. And not to say that it's untrue, but he's been labeled as a defensive liability. And I think those murmurs have gone, reverberated enough around the league that there are going to be voters who think twice before they put him on that ballot.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think the narrative with him is just so strong towards like a negative defensive player, which, and you mentioned, is probably true. But then, Jamal Crawford has all of that same stuff. Jamal Crawford's a terrible defender, and he's, the label of sixth man of the year. I think Enes Kanter will probably finish second. I really like his his chances to even win, just because my first place would probably be Andre Iguodala, just because he provides it both on offense and defense. But he's missed at least a significant portion of the season. So I think Enes Kanter, and we actually had a piece go up, I don't know, last week or the week before about Enes's chances. And he's got a strong chance, but I don't, he wouldn't be mine right now. But if you're a bettor, maybe throw a couple bucks on him. Okay, so this is a game I like to play a lot, and I know we talked about it last time, so I want to challenge you to talk about somebody different, and I will do the same, and I'll start if you want me to. But the Thunder aren't probably realistic contenders right now. And just by contenders, I mean actually able to beat, you'd pick them 50 times out of 100 to beat the Warriors or Spurs. So who is the worst player that the Thunder could acquire and become a realistic contender?
Well, as you know, I said Kyle Korver last time. That's kind of my prepared answer. Why don't you go first? Because I'm gonna really quickly, I'm thinking, racking my brain, who'd be my next choice?
No problem. So I chose JJ Redick last time, and my thought was a shooter who can fill in that two, the two guard, the off guard next to Russell Westbrook, and he has some, he's not a great defender, but he's not going to give anything away. A guy I was really hoping, I don't know, would come over. There were a couple of probably unrealistic trade scenarios where Ibaka goes to Boston, and in return, the Thunder could get Jae Crowder. And I don't know if he's necessarily the worst player that the Thunder could acquire, because I think Jae Crowder is actually fantastic. There might be someone at a lower level, but I think if the Thunder had Jae Crowder, and I don't know where you put him, because he's not really a off guard, and there's a gluttony of three and four, or I guess big men that the Thunder have, but I think Jae Crowder's up there. He's at least a reliable shooter. He's a fantastic defender. He's going to do some of those things that sort of Steven Adams does, but in a smaller mold. So I guess I was a little unprepared too, because I probably could have picked someone worse. Jake, this is no slight on Jae Crowder. He's actually a really, really good player, but he's probably my player for the worst realistic option that would make the Thunder contenders.
Okay, I thought about it, and I'm actually also going to pick a Boston Celtic. I'm going to take Avery Bradley. And the thinking with Korver before is that I didn't really want anyone else that took the ball out of Westbrook or Durant's hands, but was going to punish teams coming off the screen or they couldn't leave him. He was going to punish teams if they left him open. And I think Korver would have been great on the Thunder team. I think Avery Bradley, obviously not to the same extent. He can knock the ball down from outside. But he also brings, the Thunder defense is sometimes worrisome. And I think he's a really good perimeter defender you can add in there beside Westbrook. You can play in relief of Westbrook and handle the ball a little bit if he had to. But I mean, he can play off ball as a shooter. He can guard the opposing team's best perimeter player. I think Avery Bradley would have been really great with Oklahoma as well.
Yeah, I probably like your option a little more than mine, just because I think for Avery Bradley, is maybe not quite as good as Jae Crowder, but fits better with the Thunder. It's when he signed his contract, which was 4 years, $32 million in total. What was it before last season? It was seen as sort of like a terrible contract, and at the time it probably was. It felt like the Celtics could have gotten him for cheaper, but now, with the salary cap explosion this summer, it looks like it's going to be a fantastic contract with the average starter. And a lot of guys have talked about this, but around $15 million or so, and you've got a very good shooter, a very good defender, and even some a guy that's capable of playing a little bit on the ball at, half of that is really good. So I like that option probably a little more than mine. So let's head over to one of the pieces that you wrote earlier this week, which was over at Hoop Mag. It was called "Setting Sail or Sinking Ship," and it was about the Clippers. Without giving too much away, because I want everyone to go check it out, and I'll link it in the post below. But can you talk about some of the things that you found while researching for your piece?
Yeah, and I mean, when we talked about it before, it really was, I think a lot of times as a writer, have your hypothesis, you really want to write your piece one way and you're looking for evidence to support that. And it was one of those rare situations where I went in thinking one thing and came out thinking another. And I think when I went in, I thought the Clippers were, you know, this is the boom or bust year. If things didn't work out, they had to break it up. But without, you know, like you said, without spoiling it, I didn't leave the piece feeling that way.
Yeah, it's it was a really good piece, and I think I'm with you in that it's it might not necessarily be the case, and that is something that, you know, with a lot of the pieces that I've written, I always go in sort of with a conclusion, because I just think that's how you write. You write something because you think you know, or you want to get your point out there, or, you know, whatever it is, you have some bias. But I think a lot of the what, you know, really good writers do is they use the information, or they use what they've learned through their research to kind of guide them in the piece. And I think that's what you did in this. So I like I said, I encourage everyone to go check it out. It's over at Hoop Mag. Again, it's called Setting Sail or Sinking Ship. It's all about the Clippers and sort of their future mold, or, you know, and or current. So let's talk about one of those players a little bit more. Chris Paul. Chris Paul, and I'm going to go ahead and throw it out there, as a Thunder fan, is still one of my favorite players in the league to watch. You know, despite all of his antics, his flopping, his whining, just his play is so appeasing. It's so much fun to watch. He's so good in the pick and roll. Let's talk as more of an all-time ranking. Where does Chris Paul rank for you? Not necessarily like 1-2. You don't have to break it down, but maybe give me a tier. Who would you put him next to, or just as a general all-time ranking? What do you think about Chris Paul?
I have him higher now. Even in the off season, I was kind of, I guess, underrated in my own mind. And the more that I look at him, the more I think this guy should be higher up the list. I think he's better than Jason Kidd already. I mean, Jason Kidd won a championship, but he didn't win it as the guy. I think you can lump him right in with there with Nash. I think he's in the top 30, 35 players ever already. I really do. And I think that everyone would kind of come to that conclusion as well if he could just be, you know, the key cog on a championship team, because the blinders are just on for the public until you get that first ring. And when, you know, one of the stats in the article is of all active players, Chris Paul is the second highest playoff player efficiency rating behind only LeBron James. I mean, he really is a phenomenal player, and the thought that he's a choke artist or doesn't show up in the playoffs is really false narrative.
Yeah, I encourage everyone who still thinks that Chris Paul is a choker to go watch Game 7 of the first round of last year, when he hit that nice little floater to beat the Spurs while, you know, basically playing on one hamstring. He was hampered pretty badly. Yeah, I think I have Chris Paul, you know. I don't necessarily like to rank players such as, you know, as 1, 2, 3 and so on, give them sort of that ranking, but I do like to rank them in tiers. And I think Magic Johnson's probably in a tier of his own. You know, the championships, the accolades, all of that sort of speaks for itself. But I would probably have Chris Paul as maybe even the leader of the tier just below that. I think Chris Paul, you know, like I said, it's not only so much fun to watch him play, but it's also incredibly efficient. He's, you know, his assist to turnover ratio has always been incredible, always one of the best point guards in the league, and not just point guards, but anybody in the league. And, you know, when you're talking about a player who holds the ball that much and a player who passes the ball that much, you know, that's something that you have to take into consideration. And, you know, then talk about his shooting, which has improved. His game, his mid-range game is phenomenal. So everything about Chris Paul is fun to watch for me, you know, despite all the extra antics. So I think I agree with you that it's not necessarily all about championships when you're relying on Doc Rivers, the GM, to put personnel around you.
And Sean, I just... While we're here, take a second. I mean, we didn't talk about this last time, but people always throw Curry and Westbrook at the top of the NBA point guards right now, and it's fair, but Chris Paul hasn't really slowed down. I don't think people realize. I mean, he still leads everybody in assist percent per his team. Redick and Jordan combined, I think they're like 79% assisted on their makes. As a, you know, you're a Thunder guy. If you could swap Westbrook and Chris Paul for the postseason this year, does that make the Thunder better, the Clippers better, neither better, or both better?
I think it hurts the Clippers, but I also think it hurts. I think it hurts the Thunder. I think it probably hurts both teams because how they play is almost indicative of their point guard. The Clippers really like their four-out system with a phenomenal ball handler. And Chris Paul, you know, while he's not the scorer that Russell Westbrook is, he never has a bad night as far as assists and turnovers. And Westbrook isn't the same way. You know, there are times where Westbrook's going to have 9, 10 assists and still 6, 7 turnovers. And the Clippers can't have that. You know, and in the same way, the Thunder rely more on isolation, and while, like I said earlier, that's not necessarily Westbrook's game, he's still able to get in there, create havoc, to you know, to kick out to shooters, but the pick and roll is not always his favorite part of the game. So I think it really does make both worse. But to your point, I talked a little bit about this. I went on a podcast with Ty Windisch, actually, over he writes for the Bucks, and I'll link that below also. But I actually had Chris Paul third in my MVP ranking this year because of what he's done. You know, the Clippers being the four seed at a time where they don't have Blake Griffin, and you know, they're at least competing with the Thunder for that three seed. I think it's pretty sealed now. But, you know, it's something that he's been very good, I guess. I guess, what are your MVP rankings right now? How high would you have Chris Paul?
I think I'd have him fourth. I would go Curry's obviously far and away winning the MVP. I'd have Kawhi Leonard second. I'd have Kevin Durant third. I'd put Chris Paul fourth. And I could easily put Chris Paul up to third. I just think that I almost feel like protective of Kevin Durant because people always seem to throw him under the pile. And even he's clearly the best player on his own team, but half the league won't tell you that.
Yeah, he's. I think Kevin Durant's pretty clearly the best player on his team. And I don't know. It's tough to assign value for that right now. Okay, let's move on to Dallas a little bit. Dallas is your team, correct?
They are. I'll claim them.
So tell me a little bit about that. How did you start? You live in Canada, correct?
So I live way up in Canada. I do not live in an igloo. I'm not quite that far north. If you watch the Oscars, you can hear Leonardo DiCaprio talk about how he had to go to the very world. Come shoot right outside my home city. But my mom was a flight attendant. I grew up with a mom that flew all over the world, and I got myself a Dallas Cowboys t-shirt and a Dallas Mavericks t-shirt from her when I was, I think, 5 or 6 years old. And it was literally 97 or 98, so just after the Cowboys' great run ended. So I've been a Dallas fan ever since.
That's, yeah, and we talked about this a little bit last time, but as a you know, former Texan, I guess there's something sad about the Cowboys in their current state. But let's avoid that for this one. So tell me, Rick Carlisle's always been one of my favorite coaches, and I did another podcast, what was it, a couple of weeks ago with Duncan Smith, where we talked about top five coaches. I want you to tell me where you would have Rick Carlisle sort of in that tier.
I think he's still a top five coach. I mean, there's things that annoy everyone on social media. One of my biggest pet peeves with the Dallas fans right now is the slander that keeps coming Rick's way. And unbelievable. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, got the franchise's first championship, that has had guys that he really didn't want on his roster and found ways to get to the playoffs, that found ways to get 50 wins with an aging Dirk. I mean, there's very few coaches I would trade Rick Carlisle for, if any. I think Popovich is the only guy that I for sure hands down take, and I could argue Rick with just about anybody else.
Yeah, and I think I would. I had Carlisle second in – well, I went back and amended. I actually forgot Carlisle. We won't talk about that too much. But I went back, and I would actually have him second right behind Popovich. And I'm not the originator of this, but I did hear a podcast that I thought was brought up a very good point, in that you talk about Steve Kerr and you talk about Brad Stevens, and while they appear to be very good coaches and they're both doing tremendous jobs, they haven't had to adapt. They haven't had to do anything different. They've been given a great situation or are very good coaches in their current mold. But you look at Rick Carlisle, and he's been good for however long now, right? And you look at his tenure in Dallas, and basically the only constants are Dirk Nowitzki and Mark Cuban. And besides that, they've overhauled the roster completely, and they've still been very good. And, the sort of the same thing with Greg Popovich. So I think I'm right there with you in that it's pretty clearly Pop at number one, but I would go Carlisle number two. Okay, let's... We might as well talk about it. I wasn't able to catch the game, but the Celtics beat the Warriors last night in Golden State, which no one had done. In I think SB Nation wrote something up that was pretty funny, talking about the last time the Warriors lost at home during the regular season, what had happened. But the Celtics beat the Warriors last night, ending the home win streak. They're not going to go 41-0 anymore at home. I know you said you didn't catch too much of the game, but what are your just overlying thoughts on everything Golden State? And let's talk about them just a little bit, because they're on pace to set the records still. Just give me a quick rundown on your thoughts on the Warriors.
Well, first of all, in regards to the longest home winning record, who cares? I mean, it means nothing to me. Not to take anything away from the Celtics, I mean, beating the Warriors is what matters to me. Beating them at home, I don't care. It is what it is. I know the stats go back to home court advantage matters, but the only number that I'm really interested in is 73 or not 73. Mm-hmm. Do they get the overall record or don't they? And this puts them in an interesting situation. The chances of the Celtics seeing, I'd be more interested if the Celtics were out west and there was a potential matchup before the finals, but for this to even matter, you have to see the Celtics in the finals, which isn't going to happen. What makes this interesting is now the Warriors have to go 5-1 over their last six games to get the record, including a game with Portland and two games with San Antonio. And I think it'll be interesting to see if Pop rests his guys or doesn't rest his guys. That's the story here for me.
Yeah, I think the home thing is interesting only in that no one's ever done it before. No one's ever gone 41-0, and I think it would have been fun to see it. And I guess there's still a possibility with the Spurs, although they still do have to face the Warriors once at home. But you're right. 73 is probably the number that we should all be looking toward. But it's and even with last night's loss, it made it a little less certain, I guess, because like we talked about, if they slip up one more time, then they have to beat the Spurs both times. They end. I think it goes Spurs, Grizzlies, Grizzlies, Spurs in their last four games, and now they have to beat the Spurs at least once, and if they slip up, they have to beat them twice. And there's just some things going on there that I think it made last night's game a little interesting. Like I said, wasn't able to watch it, but I might go back, and it might be one of the games that I catch on League Pass later on. Okay, so just a look ahead at the Thunder schedule. The Thunder play the Houston Rockets tomorrow, which is the matinee ABC game. They'll go to Denver on Tuesday, to Portland on Wednesday. Josh, do you have anything to plug before we head out?
No, I mean, you can look at my articles. I got stuff coming out for Hoop Mag and Today's Fast Break every Tuesday or Wednesday, so give me a look.
Yeah, and you did just have something go up on Today's Fast Break about Curry's season, correct?
I did, yeah. It's Wednesday I had that piece called.
Yeah, go check that out. Another thing that'll be linked below. It might just be a whole bunch of links, but that's okay. You guys should go read all this stuff anyway. I had something go up late last week about Clint Capella, just how he could be a Dwight Howard replacement, maybe one that's going to help them in a few different scenarios. So go check that out. As always, go read Thunderous Intentions, some power ranking stuff, a playoff preview, a whole bunch of stuff going out. Follow Josh on Twitter at Josh Eberle, EBERLEY. Follow me at Sean_Woods15. We are on iTunes. Make sure you go check us out. Leave us a review. Also on the Hardwood Paroxysm Podcasting Network. So hopefully you're checking us out there. Maybe even was where you heard this originally. Hey, Josh, I appreciate you coming on again, taking out another 30, 35 minutes of your day for me. Go check this stuff out. Hey, Josh, I will talk to you later, man.
Thanks for having me.
Over Cuomo, Malcolm, Duck Rock, G.G. Allen, Suicide, 10th month, trick or treat, who are you supposed to be? Son, who, me? Never. Sorry, Mike Serra, but skills on terror. Apparently geek, but the speech be terror. Jones, the man in the mirror, die with the king like Farrah. Too soon? Never. Mind the bollocks, McLaren, no, not again. Is he gonna ever fall off? No. Next question, no resurrection, a rose on his necktie, elevator up, tell Orville I said hi, bye, waving cane on, looking up, up and away with my cape off, gone. Don't stop believing. Black screen me. Series finale. Jimmy go bye bye. Don't cry for me, Madonna. I'm fine. Hits another Sunday morning like a Lionel hit. Another 15 minutes in my biopic. Joaquin, give those whiskers a tiny trim. Put this toque on and start rhyming in a higher pitch. Tell Affleck it's time to film. We only got one take. Roll sound. I'm drowning in a river outside of the Viper. While fleeing, Winona Ryder's ex. Sing about Stipe, like whichever Phoenix you're a fan of. Wolfgang, rock me, Amadeus, decisive. Swan song, sing one. I'm tired, time to go to bed, Brian.